Today on the 21st, we continue revisiting some of our favorite conversations from the past year, which, of course, was an election year. That means we had a number of interviews about former presidents, whose past actions often echo into the present. First, in the midst of some of the bloodiest days of the Civil War, two newspapers published a damaging hoax, allegedly written by President Lincoln himself. We'll discuss how fake news almost brought down the Union and how it persists today. My guest was Elizabeth Mitchell, author of the new book, Lincoln's Lie. Then, President Trump's attacks on the media have frequently been described as unprecedented, but historian Harold Holzer found past presidents have gone so far as to imprison journalists whose coverage they didn't like. We'll talk to Holzer about his latest book, The Presidents Versus the Press. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up today on The 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today, we're going to revisit two conversations we've had this year about former presidents and their relationship with the press. Later, we'll hear my interview with Lincoln scholar and author Harold Holzer, whose latest book is called The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. But first, in 1864, as the Civil War was raging on and in the midst of some of its bloodiest battles, a couple of widely circulated New York-based newspapers published what today would be considered fake news. It sent the Union and President Lincoln into a frenzy and almost took them down. In response, Lincoln sent soldiers to arrest the editors. Fast forward to 2020, and a distrust of the media among political leaders and the public seems to be at historically high levels. A recent Gallup poll suggested 4 out of 5 Americans think news organizations advocate political viewpoints rather than report the news free of bias. In October, we spoke with Elizabeth Mitchell, author of Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. Mitchell is also former executive editor of George magazine and has written for various outlets, including The Wall Street Journal, The Chicago Tribune, and The Nation. Here's my conversation with Elizabeth Mitchell. Elizabeth, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Let's start from a very basic premise. What was Lincoln's Lie?
Well, the interesting thing in when I'm telling the story and in my research is that Lincoln tells a number of lies, actually, through his presidency. Some are, you know, little white lies and some are more significant. And so one of the things that you come across is that in this particular incident of fake news, he reacts with the most anger that, you know, witnesses had seen him respond to any event in his presidency, apparently. And he orders this immediate arrest of the newspaper editors and the shutting down of these newspaper offices. So you had armed guards in these offices, these major New York papers, for several days. The interesting thing, and I don't want to give away everything because, you know, I did write the book in a way hoping that people would get the kind of intrigue that I experienced when I was doing the research. But
no spoilers.
Actually,
we will try.
I know,
no,
but I will say this: it might not have been fake news. So his position, you know, his extreme reaction, is potentially even a cover up.
So can you describe for listeners what actually set him off? What got him so angry? Right.
So the background is basically, you know, and I find it really interesting, this the scene of, you know, what happened, which is that at, you know, 3 a.m, you know, a 17-year-old boy is running through the streets of New York, all going up and down the newspaper row to deliver this proclamation. It's supposedly an Associated Press paper, the same handwriting as the Associated Press. And he delivers it to these newspaper offices when the editors have all gone for the day, but there's still a printer on hand. And the printer sees it, sees that there's this proclamation from Abraham Lincoln saying, the war is going terribly. Why are we the sufferers of our century? We must all basically pray and fast to make amends. And I would need 400,000 more men to go to the front. And if I don't get them through volunteerism, I'm going to set a draft immediately. So these printers decide that they've got to run the story, because if they don't, they'll look like they're taking a political position. And so two of the papers run it. There were others that were closer together so they could communicate more directly about what they thought this announcement was. But these two were the ones who ran it, and it caused a huge ruckus in New York. And then beyond that, you know, there was gold went skyrocketing on Wall Street. People were gathering in the streets to fight and, you know, and worry about what was going to happen next. And the most significant thing was that there was a boat that was about to go to Europe carrying the news of the Union. And both France and England were sort of anxious to recognize the Confederacy. They thought it'd be easier for business. And so they were about to get this information that would make them think the Union was over. So there was a lot at stake.
In the context here, these are not the New York draft riots when people talk about that. I think that was 1863, if I'm correct about that. But I mean, that is the backdrop. I mean, that had happened in New York. That was there. So there was this palpable anger already sort of like set to go, right?
Yeah, I mean, no one wanted to repeat the draft riots. We have a sense of it from, you know, Gangs of New York and movies like that. But the reality was, it was one of the most brutal incidents of our history. There were basically raging mobs running through the streets of New York for 5 days. They were basically white people. They killed, you know, something in the order of 175 black people by lynching, mutilation, etc. They set fire to all sorts of buildings. They, you know, it was horrible. And basically, the only thing that stopped them, the police were helpless, but the military had to come up from the front lines to quiet it. So that was the backdrop. People were afraid what the response would be if another draft came right at that moment.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, we are re-airing a conversation I had in October with Elizabeth Mitchell. She authored a book about Abraham Lincoln and a moment in his presidency where he launched an attack on the press. The book is called Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. You mentioned a little while ago that President Lincoln was as angry as anyone had ever seen him. What was sort of the result of that? What did he send in? You can talk a little bit about, you know, sending in people to arrest the publishers and stop the presses, I guess.
Yes. It was a big deal in terms of it. You know, it would be like if, you know, suddenly NBC or, you know, CNN were under guard. And, you know, I mean, it's a traumatic experience for the general public. And so it actually created a constitutional crisis. There were calls for Lincoln's impeachment, for, you know, his suppression of free speech, of, you know, taking a private operation militarily without any kind of trial ahead of time. So, but the other thing he did, which, you know, was he shut down the telegraph throughout the country, and that was their internet. I mean, at that point, it was so ubiquitous, people would, you know, change their plans even within a day. Like, we're not going to have dinner, we're going to go to the opera, you know, that kind of thing would be communicated. So this was suddenly the shutdown of the wire services throughout the East Coast, certainly, and going out towards the West.
Let's take a step back. I'm curious, what made you want to write this story, right? In Springfield, there's a, you know, I don't know if this is true or a cliche, but Lincoln is one of the most, you know, written about people in history. And I know in Springfield, there's a bookstore right next to the old state capitol where Lincoln gave his famous House Divided speech, and it has just a wall of Civil War and Lincoln books. So I'm curious about That seems like a brave step into that.
No, absolutely. I mean, even when I was proposing this to the publishers, I said, I cannot make the case, you know, that he hasn't been written about. I mean, he's probably the most written about figure in all of American history. And once you write about him, you understand why. I mean, I could now spend the rest of my life, you know, studying him. And so, and I have to say, it's very exciting to be on your show, because now I have such, you know, I'm so attached to your area. But What happened was I was working on another book, the book that preceded this, which was called Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty. And in that book, I had recognized from finding a diary of the artist who made the statue that the statue wasn't actually what I had always assumed, you know, just this gift from the French government to the American government, but it was actually this artist who had no support and came over here knowing no one, just with the idea that he wanted to make this colossus. And so it was such a fantastic, intriguing story. It occupied me for a couple of years. When I was researching that, the newspaper, The World, was the one that Joseph Pulitzer used to promote the Liberty fundraising. And he had bought that paper at a cut rate price. And it said because of this scandal in 1864, the paper had been so discredited that they could never, you know, get themselves quite back on their feet. It said the part about Lincoln's reaction, it was about this fake news. And that so surprised me because, you know, of course, like most Americans, you know, I've revered Abraham Lincoln and certainly, and, you know, it's his courage in the circumstance that he was in has been so crucial. But I hadn't understood that he had some issues with, say, you know, habeas corpus. I knew that one actually, but I mean, I didn't know his freedom of speech stuff was so prickly. So I started looking into it. And then when I was looking into it, it got richer and richer. It was not only the resonances with where we are today. I mean, across the board, you know, I already talked about the telegraph and, you know, its relation to the internet, but it's also, you know, the way the media was divided up, you know, some of the characters that were part of it, Wall Street, what it was doing during this time, the partisan divide, on and on. And so it became really quite fascinating. And then also every time I would research and think I'd found the culprit, there would be this reversal where I'd find something new, you know, so it's really a fascinating story. And then there's that part where once you come across a story like that, just as a writer, I was excited at the idea of writing it in that kind of whodunit mode, because there is that element when you're writing a book, you kind of really want to delight your readers, I guess. And so this story fascinated me. I hoped I conveyed it.
Yeah, and you talked about the partisan press at the time. And mm-hmm. I know in Springfield, there was the Journal newspaper and the Register newspaper, and the Journal was Lincoln's friend and the Register was his avowed enemy. And we've come to hear this term in the last few years of fake news. Mm-hmm. It's in the subtitle of your book, but I'm guessing that was not what politicians used back then. But how did they talk about reporting and journalism that they didn't like?
Well, an interesting thing is that on, for example, stories from the front, the Civil War front, they would put a slug above it that would say, "This is interesting if true." And everyone just was fine with that, you know, because all they wanted was some information from the front. And they, as, you know, mature readers could say, okay, that's probably somewhat true, or I need to check other sources or what have you. I think people were more comfortable with the idea that they were getting information that, you know, it's generated by humans and, you know, humans are complex people, complex entities. You know, they have the story has to do with how many sources you have and who your sources are and what their agenda is. And so newspaper, I love reporters. I think that journalists are some of the bravest, most extraordinary servants of our society. But I also think that you have to at some points use your judgment and sift out what you think has a little bit of spin on it. And that doesn't mean it's completely to be discounted, but you need to sort of have a, you know, the same kind of wisdom you bring into, you know, buying a car or what have you. You don't just take the first pitch. So in any case, there was a lot of, there were actually a lot of hoax stories that were circulating even before this. One of the most famous is the moon hoax story, which was the New York Sun ran 6 days of stories that were scientific in nature about the fact that this particular well-known scientist had found, with his telescope, had seen cavorting animals on the moon, unicorns and, you know, frolicking little beasts, kind of Dr. Seuss characters, and everyone went for it. They loved it. So there was a kind of somewhat whimsical, let's say, somewhat dangerous, you know, tendency to run these hoax stories. We don't have them on that level now. If they exist, they're for very partisan, you know, reasons.
Yeah. Well, let's try and bridge to the now a little bit with this idea of fake news. Early on in the book, you point out in the run-up to the 1860 election that Lincoln actually secretly purchased a German language newspaper, the Illinois yes. Staatsanzeiger. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but it realizing he needed to win the German-American vote in order to win yeah. the election. I mean, I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like today if, you know, Joe Biden or Donald Trump bought a major media outlet. Obviously, that'd be a pretty big scandal. Can you talk a little bit about that and how the yeah. dynamics have changed there?
Well, I mean, I think that's Harold Holzer is where, you know, is the person who originally uncovered that, you know, at least to my research. And it's so interesting because it's a secret contract. He drew it up and, you know, and it shows such savvy. I mean, in terms of wanting that particular vote, this is not the clodhopper, you know, that kind of crack on Lincoln. This was someone who really knew how to play the media. So, you know, there's that. And he continues with this sort of thing as he goes on. You know, at one point, his White House staffers are writing anonymous stories reporting on goings on in D.C., but it's put off as if it's, you know, just a regular journalist. But, you know, we have similar situations in as much as, for example, the relationship between David Pecker, who was a former employer of mine, and Donald Trump. You know, that relationship was, you know, Trump, you know, using money, you know, funneling money through to, you know, pay off people he wanted paid off, essentially. There's, you know, there are some similarities in these ways. But I think, you know, rightfully, there would be, if it came about somebody had actually purchased a paper or something, I think the public would have a huge outcry. Of course, in Lincoln's time, they didn't have the benefit of knowing this. We found this out in the, you know, by studying the archives.
We have to take a break here. We're re-airing my conversation with Elizabeth Mitchell, author of Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. More to come after the break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. All this week, we're rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations from 2020. Today, we're having our own President's Day, featuring authors of books about presidents and the presidency. Coming up, historian Harold Holzer, author of The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. But first, the conclusion of my conversation with Elizabeth Mitchell. She's the author of Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. The book came out in October, which is when I first interviewed Mitchell. We're re-airing that conversation today. Here's the conclusion. The book is about Lincoln, but it's also about the media as a whole,
yeah.
right? And I mentioned it in the introduction to our conversation, the statistic from Gallup on American distrust in the media. 4 in 5 Americans say that they think the media advocates political viewpoints rather than reporting the news free of bias. I mean, you mentioned a little bit about sort of people having an understanding of the sort of like, whoa, if true, way to read the news mm-hmm. from the Civil War front. Can you talk? I mean, was that trust in the media better or worse or just different in Lincoln's time?
Well, one thing was that it was actually more partisan back then. And so people knew what they were getting, you know, and in as much as the, you know, Henry Raymond, for example, was at the Times was very much a Lincoln supporter. He became a Lincoln supporter and, you know, he was a big player in the party as well. Most of the editors sort of had declared their allegiances outright and then the news would follow that. I think that, you know, first of all, I think, you know, Trump has done some real damage. He's doing it just to, you know, sort of have an enemy he can fight against. You know, I don't even know that he believes what he says when he says fake news about certain outlets. For example, I went back and tracked how many times he calls CNN fake news and slams them. And then you look at his other tweets and he's thanking them for running his, you know, his live events, or giving them a shout out for something that they did that was a direct cover, you know, directly covering him. So he sort of plays that card when he doesn't like what they're reporting. I think that so I think some of that has been drummed up, and I think one day we'll get over that. I think people will start to remember why they trust journalists, because here's the thing: nobody's out there really giving the speech for journalists, but most of the things that, you know, your lives, everyone's life has been affected by journalism in terms of, you know, reporting on a, you know, the scandal of, you know, money embezzled in political scenes, or, you know, environmental issues where your water is in, you know, not good or what have you. And we probably need a little bit more advocacy of, you know, the ways in which journalism touches your life every day.
And in fact, you dedicate the book to all reporters, past and present, who witness.
Yeah.
You know, we're coming to the end of our conversation. And before I let you go, I can't let you go without asking about George, if I can, the late Political magazine, where you were for several years executive editor. I still miss George. I have friends who still talk about it from time to time. Can you first just briefly describe George for people who might not have read it back in the day?
Sure. And that's so nice to hear from you, I have to say. So George Magazine was a political magazine started by John Kennedy Jr. And his idea was that it wasn't helpful to people to only hear from the, actually it was postpartisan. I mean, it really would be necessary today. So his idea was to cover politicians in, you know, across the spectrum, and basically look at them as, you know, what did they promise? Are they true to the promises? What motivates them? You know, are, you know, what are their foibles? And it was just an incredible experience. And it was so interesting how it opened up politics to people who hadn't been very active before. I mean, particularly female readers. We aimed to have half and half, you know, female, male. There had never been a political magazine that had that kind of skew. And we got there. And I mean, even today, so many of the players that we covered are important now. I mean, Kellyanne Conway was somebody who used to stop by the George offices. You know, there was, you know, all of them. Biden was, you know, we were covering, you know, et cetera. I just think John would have been very interested in covering this particular moment.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being on with us today on the 21st.
It was really lovely to be here. Thank you.
Elizabeth Mitchell is the author of Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. The book came out in October. Before we move on to my next conversation with presidential historian Harold Holzer, I want to take the opportunity to promote the 21st podcast. You perhaps are listening to this show on the radio right now, but sometimes you can't always make it during the 11 o'clock live broadcast, but you can always catch up with all the great Illinois news, politics, science, history, culture, entertainment, arts, sports, everything, the wide gamut of stories the 21st covers. It's all there in our podcast feed, organized neatly by segment. So if something interests you, download it. Great. If you want to skip something, that's fine too. You can find us, links to our podcast feed at our website, which is 21stshow.org, or you can just open up your favorite podcasting app and find us that way. Just search for The 21st. That's the 21st, the 21st. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, just about anywhere you can find a podcast. And finally, while you're there, if you like the show, please rate us, leave a short review. It helps other people discover the 21st and be connected with our Illinois community that we're building here on the show. Okay, That out of the way, my conversation with historian Harold Holzer is coming up in just a moment. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. President Trump's attacks on the media have frequently been described as unprecedented.
Of the 44 presidents who've held this office before him, many have at times criticized the media, but none have declared a full-on war against the press like Donald Trump.
Fake news!
But as long as there have been presidents of the United States, there have been presidents complaining about their coverage in the press. While we don't have tape of James K. Polk or Grover Cleveland, it has been a regular feature of politics, certainly since the dawn of electronic media.
Motion picture cameras join newspaper reporters in the old State Department building for an historic presidential press conference, the first ever filmed in sound by newsreel cameramen. More than 200 correspondents are crowded in the chamber as the president strides briskly in to face the press and the cameras.
Well, I see we're trying a new experiment this morning. I hope it doesn't prove to be a disturbing influence. I have no announcements. We'll go directly to questions.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting in 27 years of public life.
So how but can
you guarantee that they're going to be able to keep their doctor?
Brett, you got
to
let me finish my answers.
But sir, I know you don't like the filibuster.
I'm trying to answer your questions, and you keep on interrupting. So let me be clear.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect. Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization.
You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir? Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No.
And as bad as things have been in recent years, past presidents have imprisoned people for publishing things they don't like. A few months ago, I spoke with historian Harold Holzer about the often tense relationship between presidents and the press from Abraham Lincoln to Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Holzer has written, co-written, or edited dozens of books, and his latest is called The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. Here's our conversation, which we originally broadcast in September. Harold Holzer, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us today.
What a great collection of sound bites that was. Loved it.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a rich archive to delve into, at least for the last 60 years or so. So I want to begin. Your book is structured chronologically, and I want to begin. But I want to begin with the introduction, where you talk about a tantrum by a president. I'm not naming him yet, but This president was outraged at the latest indignity at the hands of the press. In this case, it was an unflattering political cartoon. One of his cabinet secretaries later recalled the president saying he'd rather be dead than living through what he was dealing with. Who was this petulant president?
Very alliterative. The petulant president was George Washington. And he proceeded to throw the newspaper to the floor and jump up and down on it with his heavy boots, much to the amusement of Thomas Jefferson, who wrote that observation. Although it was Jefferson, interestingly, who had imported the first anti-George Washington newspaper to work in the Capitol to undermine public confidence in Washington. And not only begged this journalist to come from New York to Philadelphia, but gave him a job in the State Department as a translator to sort of subvent his enterprise. An extraordinary moment showing how important the press was, even at the dawn of the Republic, for sure.
You know, in another thing you write about Washington is we often think today of his decision to serve only two terms.
Right.
is establishing a sort of what, the Cincinnatus-like precedent for the office, right? It's one of the measures of his greatness. But you find that he may have had other motives for his retirement.
Yeah, I think, sure, the Cincinnatus imperative was strong. That is, return to the farm, don't do a monarchy. But in the draft of his famous farewell address, a paragraph that didn't make the final cut made it clear, as he put it, that the gazettes of the United States have teemed with invective, disappointment, ignorance of fact, misrepresenting his politics, wounding his reputation. And I think it's pretty clear that he was getting out because 5 years of his eight had been characterized by brutal criticism, not only political, but personal. You know, saying that some anti-federalist papers were alleging that he had that he'd stuffed his expense accounts, that he'd marched out of Washington illegal, not out of Washington, out of Philadelphia illegally to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, that he had behaved badly in his military career. I mean, this was really wounding to someone who generally was not used to any kind of criticism, much less this kind of invective.
And it's interesting, we think of him today, you know, he's represented literally by an obelisk in Washington, is this stoic, solid presence. But he was so thin-skinned, you talk about.
But you know, by the way, last time I looked, he was represented by an obelisk. That's another conversation entirely. I hope it stays there, but it's becoming as controversial in some quarters as Confederate monuments. Yeah, he was thin-skinned. I mean, again, unused to criticism. Adams was thin-skinned and did much more than Donald Trump to crack down against dissent. Lincoln was not thin-skinned particularly. He himself once said that he had never been in a political campaign where that was not characterized by huge amounts of abuse, and that he'd never been quite free of ridicule in his entire life. He said it rather sadly. And yet Lincoln is still the all-time champion for shutting down newspapers and imprisoning editors, belligerent anti-Lincoln editors.
Yeah, and I want to dwell on Lincoln a little, because this is an Illinois show, and we are broadcasting out of Central Illinois. We do need to take a break in about 3 minutes, so I just want to warn you, we'll have to interrupt here in a moment. But I want to begin with this idea of sort of what was the press like, right? Some years ago, I worked for the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield, which is a successor to the Sangamo Journal. And there was a quote on the wall of outside the newsroom. It said, from Lincoln, "The Journal paper was always my friend, and of course, its editors the same," unquote. I mean, I can't imagine modern newsrooms doing something like that for a contemporary politician. I mean, even Fox News is not going to have a compliment from President Trump on the wall. So what was the American press like at the time of the Civil War?
Completely aligned with political parties. So the Journal started as a Whig paper. It became a Republican paper. It was always for Lincoln. Lincoln hung out there. He was in the office of the Journal when news of his nomination came to Springfield from Chicago. They were collaborators in the Whig and Republican causes. But just to make sure that our listeners know, and of course you know, that even though the names of the papers are commingled today on the masthead, the Register was always Lincoln's enemy. Its editors were his enemies. They were Stephen Douglas men. They ridiculed and attacked Lincoln both when he was a Whig and when he was a Republican. They were a thorn in his side. But that was open partisan journalism, happily practiced, openly practiced, accepted that even the news pages were going to be partisan. If we have another second, after the first Lincoln-Douglas debate in Ottawa, the Journal wrote that Lincoln was so triumphant that his supporters carried him off on their shoulders. The Register wrote, Lincoln was so exhausted that his supporters had to carry him off on their shoulders. That's typical political news coverage in Democratic versus Republican papers in 1858.
You could read the same report in different papers and get very sort of Rashomon-like understandings of what's happening there.
Exactly.
So we're going to come back to Lincoln, who, as you know, we've established a very political press. Some newspapers, he was welcomed to Washington with one paper you write about calling him the Illinois ape. So he had good reason to dislike the press, and we're going to talk about that when we return My guest is presidential historian Harold Holzer. He's the author, most recently, of The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. We are revisiting that conversation today. It was originally broadcast here on the 21st in September. The conclusion of my interview of Harold Holzer coming up after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing to listen back to some of our favorite conversations from this year. Today, we are having our own version of President's Day, and I'm now continuing my conversation with Harold Holzer. Holzer has written, co-written, or edited dozens of books on American history, many about Abraham Lincoln. His latest is The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. And just a note to our listeners that this segment is a rebroadcast of an interview I first conducted in September. Here now is the rest of our conversation. Before the break, we were talking about Lincoln. He certainly took a lot of vitriol from quarters of the press, and he responded in kind. You call him the harshest and most repressive presidential censor yet. You have a quote in the book, you say, or I should say, quoting from the book, quote, even John Adams' Sedition Act prosecutions could not match for ferocity and scope the undeclared, unlegislated, unlitigated, and largely unchallenged war the Lincoln administration began waging against hostile domestic newspapers within months of his inauguration. What form did this war take?
So after the Battle of Bull Run, which the Union lost against all expectations, dangerously, the Union Army's first 90 and 100-day volunteers were really out of time. They had to re-up, re-enlist, or the Union Army was going to have no soldiers. When Democratic newspapers in the North began editorializing that the soldiers should maybe not re-enlist, the Lincoln administration moved in, and as far north as New York, New Hampshire, Maine even, closed down the newspapers that had recommended staying out of the army, basically, took the newspapers from post offices, threw them off trains. The State Department, the War Department, the Post Office Department all cracked out, and so did the army itself. Editors, one of whom was dragged from his bed in New York and summoned to Washington for a kind of inquisition, were put in military prisons. And this had happened even earlier when the border states like Maryland and Missouri and Kentucky teetered on the brink of secession. Lincoln wanted to stop secession there at all costs. So here's an example. In Baltimore, a Democratic editor rails against the Union Army. The military moves in, arrests the editor. His name is Francis Key Howard. And they put Howard, without a trial, in Fort McHenry. Now, that's the famous fort in Baltimore Harbor where the Star-Spangled Banner had flown during a bombardment in the War of 1812, inspiring Francis Scott Key to write the national anthem. Well, John Howard was Francis Scott Key's grandson, and that did not stop him from getting a view of Fort McHenry from the inside looking out, as opposed to what his grandfather saw.
Yeah, well said. So I have to ask, I mean, that's one anecdote among many. We are broadcasting from central Illinois, where, of course, you know, Washington the father, Lincoln the savior, the 16th president is rightly a secular saint around here. But I have to ask, on the question of press freedom, how do you rank Presidents Trump and Lincoln?
I don't like mentioning him in the same breath, but I guess we have to for purposes of this discussion. So the honest answer is that Trump is all bark and no bite. It's not inconsistent with the way he conducts himself on other issues, if I can editorialize a little. I think he treats the press sort of like the coronavirus. He realizes it's an impediment, but he's not organized enough to do anything. It's a lot of complaint, a lot of vicious rhetoric, and a man I admire so much, whom you quoted at the outset, the great First Amendment lawyer, Floyd Abrams, thinks that the corrosive drip, drip, drip of the criticism is damaging. But so many pillars of the Republic are losing the confidence of the American people, the military, the courts, the post office, the presidency, the Congress, and journalism. It's going to take a lot to agree on objective truth again, because the fact is, in the last 20 years, we have re-entered, at least on broadcast television, an era of openly partisan journalism. Well, I wouldn't say openly. It's open enough to the viewers. MSNBC and Fox News do not announce their political orientation. They both claim to be communicating objective truth. The fact is they're closely allied with each of them, respectively, with the principles of the major parties. They just don't admit it as they did in the 19th century. So I think we've come full cycle in a way back to politically oriented broadcast journalism. And in this case, the president of the United States is chipping away at confidence in either pro-democratic or pro-Republican communications platforms. I mean, he's not very nice to Fox News either when they dare to say anything critical or just observe him straightforwardly.
Right. So I want to draw another parallel that I think you draw out in your book here, which is the use of electronic media, which obviously President Trump has done so well on Twitter, but this is also not a news story. We have one other clip here. This is FDR, who is taking advantage of the growing mass medium of radio.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. And I know that when you understand what we in Washington have been about, I shall continue to have your cooperation as fully as I have had your sympathy and your help during the past week.
So as long as I've been alive, certainly we've seen presidents wanting to get around this, you know, the so-called filter of the media, right? Do you draw a connection between the fireside chats and at real Donald Trump?
I do, and that's the other thread, I think, in the book, is that the presidents who have found a way to get around the press and communicate directly to the people with new technologies have been the most successful communicators. And FDR had three things going for him. First, he was extraordinarily accessible, 998 news conferences in 12 years. Second, he was friendly and congenial to the press. And as a result, they generally hid the extent of his disability from polio. There was just a gentleman's agreement in the first 6 or 7 years of his administration, later enforced by the press office, but just a gentleman's agreement not to photograph him in his wheelchair, not to photograph him being lifted in and out of his automobiles like a doll. And that's an extraordinary hold he held over them. And then there were the fireside chats. You just played the first one. I think he sounded a little nervous, actually, compared to the audios that I heard of the next 27 over a period of 12 years. He was always nervous before he began them, but he got into a better radio rhythm. And this was, as you say, radio networks were proliferating, households with radios were exploding exponentially, and he had an extraordinary reach. People thought, I mean, my parents told me, he was on the radio every week, all the time, just 28 in 12 years, with a huge impact. And Kennedy does it again with television. You played an Eisenhower news conference, the first televised news conference, and he was clearly not happy. He said, we'll see if this is a disturbing influence, not exactly welcome and glad to have you. But JFK was a master. I'm really old enough to remember rushing home from elementary school in the fifth and sixth grade so I could hear the press conference that had been scheduled, because he was fun. He would always pick on one reporter who would ask us kind of a silly off-topic question, and he would bounce off her and just smile, and the place would crack up.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. We actually have a clip of President Kennedy getting a question from a reporter at one of his news conferences. Let's take a listen.
Mr. President, the Democratic platform in which you ran for election promises to work for equal rights for women, including equal pay, to wipe out job opportunity discriminations. Now, you have made efforts on behalf of others What have you done for the women according to the promises of the platform?
Well, I'm sure we haven't done enough, and I must say I am a strong believer in equal pay for equal work, and I think that we ought to do better than we're doing, and I'm glad that you reminded me of it.
So there you have it, President Kennedy sort of having a fairly cordial, at least in some of those televised news conferences, relationship with the press.
But that's the very woman I was referring to, May Craig. She was really a groundbreaker, and she had started in the Roosevelt era as one of only two women in these crowded daily, twice a week press conferences. And FDR gave her a hard time. He teased her a lot. By the Kennedy years, she was pretty elderly. She wore a flower pot hat on her head and made her easy for JFK to spot. And he knew when a press conference was dragging a little, he would call on her and really just had to smile in response. And that was a great example. But she did it almost every time there was a press conference. He'd find a way to call on May Craig, who was a great veteran, but also asked just delightfully loopy questions. And that wasn't such a loopy question, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
It shows you how far we've come. But it sounded exactly loopy in 1961, I promise.
That sounds right in keeping with what you'd ask about today. You know,
yeah,
we've only got a few minutes left in our conversation, unfortunately, so I'm going to speed ahead a little bit and go past Nixon and Watergate, which is obviously dealt with in your book and obviously is a turning point, the sort of celebrification, you know, Woodward and Bernstein right. being played by Redford and Hoffman. But let's jump ahead to, you know, people today talk about a sort of Trump derangement syndrome among members of the media, and that there's something about the president that's maybe a little out of proportion to what he's doing and saying that lead them to treat every utterance as a major scandal. And I want to come to that idea, but you also talk in the book about Bill Clinton and his relationship to the press, and he had this effect on some reporters. Can you talk about that parallel there?
Well, it is an interesting parallel. I'm not even sure I quite make it as directly as you did. I could not really find a rationale for reporters conducting the kind of obsessive scrutiny of Bill Clinton that they did. And Clinton is the one president that I interviewed for the book. He at this point feels they were doing their job. He's not bitter, except when it comes to Travelgate and Vincent Foster. That he will always be bitter about because he feels they were irrational, without substance, and in the Foster case, a calumny against someone he cared about and Hillary cared about deeply. And I don't think he'll ever get over that, and I'm not sure he should. But there was a derangement syndrome. Joe Klein, the reporter who was the anonymous at that time writer of the novelization of Clinton's escapades called Primary Colors, later said that he thought the only reason was we had all misbehaved in the 60s and most of us got caught. And we all resented the fact that Clinton misbehaved and he never got caught. So we were determined to catch him, which is a pretty feeble reason for subjecting a new president who I think mishandled the press from day one. He did not have the right press secretary. He and Mrs. Clinton ordered that the door be shut between the press room and the press secretary's office. Driving Helen Thomas into a rage, by the way, which is not a good way to start. So there was a derangement syndrome. And whether there is about Trump, I think Clinton never called journalists the enemies of the people. He called them enemies of the Clintons. Maybe he said there was he and Hillary said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy among some. But I think the level of rhetoric that Donald Trump has imposed on this long-existing not competition so much as tension, necessary tension between journalists and presidents is over the top now. And I think in a way the derangement is justified, but the derangement just leads to more derangement on the other side of the presidential rostrum. So it's pretty unhealthy at the moment. But as I say, and I said in an op-ed piece last week, I said, you know, there is if it's important enough to people that the press have a an ability to make inquiries without being labeled traitors, they have an opportunity to address that concern along with what other concerns they have on November 3rd, or by mail, as I said. So we'll see. As Donald Trump says at every press conference, we'll see what happens.
The book is The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. The writer is historian Harold Holzer. This interview was first broadcast in September. And that is all the time we have for today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Brielle Skullark, and Chantal Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey.